Every time I accept a speech to speak to an outside group, I get angry at myself because I'm always resolving not to take any more outside speeches because I carry a pretty heavy workload and I travel quite a bit. And this takes out time from what I'm doing. But I also have a sense of responsibility toward our community and our university and the people outside the labor movement. One of the nice things about the American labor movement, probably for any institution of its size, it has probably the worst kind of public relations possible. There's little, if any, effort done on the part of unions to interpret its activities, its hopes, its aims, its aspirations to the community, to the environment in which it operates. So I generally wind up taking on these assignments. Not that I don't enjoy them when I get here, but I think it's important that people who are active in the labor movement do get out and do try to let the people, especially the kids coming up, know a little bit about the efforts of the labor movement and its role in the society we live in. Well, the most cursory kind of a examination of the labor movement will indicate to you that it's a broad segment of our society which has for its basic purpose the betterment, the human betterment of the working people, the protection and expansion of the freedoms we enjoy in a free society. Some of us will look at it, the bread and butter activities, the narrow selfish interests which are pursued by some international unions, say, well, how can you say that? But the totality of the group, the working class of America, is a movement. It has no choice except to play a progressive role. Economic pressures that operate on a worker, the denials which face him every day, the discriminations which he lives under, force him into a position of trying to expand his horizons, try to improve his conditions, try to make for a better environment for him. And out of that comes a contribution to America as such. But if you look at the history of the labor movement, you'll find, for instance, that on all of the important issues as we developed an industrial society, all the important abuses, labor is in the forefront of fighting those. Thousands of our members and officers died in the struggle for the eight-hour day. Maybe you're familiar with the Haymarket riots right here in the city of Chicago in the state of Illinois. But that was only one incident across America where they fought for the establishment of the eight-hour day. Obviously, this occurred in a period of time when maybe not your fathers, but your grandfathers, their day's work started with the dawn, ended with the coming of night. There was no hours in the days that we were starting to fight for the eight-hour day. And, of course, we've led the battle all the time for the matter of increasing, improving the matter of wages. And I don't know how a society based on mass production could survive except through an adequate kind of purchasing power, which would never come freely at the hands of an employer, which had to come through the strength and the pressures of a organized labor movement, which brought purchasing power and improved the conditions of the working people and all of America in that respect. But there were times when, especially in our textile mills, but in all phases of industry, children were employed. Children 7, 8, 10 years old worked 10 and 12 hours a day in the textile mills in New England. Labor was the first to fight against that and to establish some kind of regulation on the hours of children, work conditions of children. The question of safety in industry, which was a horrible mess down through the early days of our nation and the building of an industrial society and still a serious problem as of today, has always been, the labor movement has always been in the forefront of trying to establish those kind of working conditions which protect the lives of people who have to work. And this is true also in terms of the matter of women's work. There was times when women had no regulations as to the nature of the work they do. They were employed in mines as well as anywhere else, and they were pretty badly treated. And there was a lot of women's legislation put on the books by the American labor movement. 1972 and 3 is seeing a change in that problem. There's a lot of opposition today to any kind of protective legislation involving women. Maybe it's in order today, but it wasn't in the old days when the first fights took place to adopt some kind of protective legislation in regards to women who work. But whether it's those sort of things or whether it's a more modern device of the pension program, Social Security, labor is in the front fighting for that kind of a program, as we are today in the forefront fighting for the establishment of federal responsibility for the medical needs of the American people. These are all things which are good things in which labor had no choice but to get in and fight for them. On broader issues, like we are part of the fight against slavery, for the abolition of slavery. We are the ones who fought and literally are probably most responsible for the existence of free public education, and probably including the state universities. And we, of course, led the fight for the franchise. There was a time when the only people who voted were those who had property, just as the only people who went to, kids who went to school were those whose fathers could afford to put them in private schools. But this is part of the background, and this is what I'm talking about, and I'm talking about the American labor movement. And not too many people are conscious of it. Now, it's like every other movement. It's made up of human beings who have all the strengths and weaknesses that, let me say, God gave them. So that here and there you'll find variations on the thing I'm saying. You'll find a guy who betrays his trust, who extorts money, who steals money, and so on. But an example, among the worst of these unions, reputedly, was the Teamsters. And we went through a tremendous investigation by the McClellan Committee, such an investigation as no other institution in society has ever gone through. And our union went through for about 3-4 years of thousands of guys all over America looking at police records, looking at newspaper files, talking to employers, trying to get something on Teamster reps. And when they got all through, we took the bother of going through the transcript of about 3 years of testimony. We found 107 names mentioned out of, for instance, we got 5,000 officers and employees in the Teamsters. We have 2 million members. But among members and officers, 107 names were revealed in that testimony, in that investigation. The only ones that surfaced. And if they were there, the McClellan Committee would have had them and would have surfaced them. But in any event, of those 107, when you broke the list down, there's about 25 guys we never heard of, never was a member of the Teamsters Union, certainly was never an officer. But they had a beautiful technique. I would be testifying as a top official of the Teamsters Union, and suddenly I'd be asked to stand aside. Now, from St. Louis, my town, they'd bring in a leading hoodlum figure. And they put him on the stand, and they knew, of course, in advance he was going to take the fifth, he'd take the fifth 100 times, they'd say goodbye. They put me back on the stand. When the newspaper reports were read, I was totally and completely identified with this hoodlum. Another guy would get on, and this technique was being was used on every one of us to just dirty us up by some kind of association. They would never accuse me directly of being under the control of a hoodlum. They would never convict me or question me about hoodlum associations, whether I was in business or anything else. But they would have put the hoodlum on right at the same time I'm on, in the middle of my presentation, in order to identify me with hoodlums. Well, anyway, there were that type of people. There was another 25 rank and filers who had come up, who in the past had a police record. They had hijacked an automobile, they had stuck somebody up with a pistol, they had engaged in certain law-breaking activities. But for 25 years, these guys had, and they're still truck drivers today, but for 25 years, they hadn't had a traffic ticket. Now, these are people who had paid their debt to society, had reformed in many respects, in all respects, as far as good citizenship was concerned, and they should have been proud of them, but no, they dragged them up as parties to the Teamsters family. And there was about another 25 guys like myself who have long police records. I've been arrested in maybe a dozen towns in this country. Never for the purpose of self-enrichment, never any schemes to make myself fat, but for the purpose in defense of our organization, and I would do it 1,000 times more, and I'm never more proud of anything in my past than my police record. But in any event, we had those kind of people. That's when you get to analyze the thing. Then we had about 25 more who wound up, 25 more who wound up having betrayed their trust while they were officers and while they were in office. They were victims, or they were found guilty of extortion, or they had engaged in a degree of violence which was not countenanced by society. And they went, at the time that we gave the testimony, there was only 6 of those individuals left inside the Teamster family. and as of today, I suspect they're all gone. But we were able to, as a result of that investigation, send out, in the passage of a law, we sent out affidavits to 4,500 people in the Teamsters Union. That's all of the officers and even the janitors and the clericals and everyone that had to sign as testifying as to their criminal background. And of the 4,500 at the time when the law was passed, we had one person who could not pass the test and had to resign his office. So that the labor movement, while it's bandied about as being corrupt, and while some of us, our people, do fall by the wayside, measured against the banking fraternity, it probably shows up like all sweetness and light. And measured against almost any other segment of society, the business community, it would be the same thing. I'll never forget one time one of our guys did some time in a jail in Texas. And he came by federal prison. He came out, and he's in the office. We were talking. We said, how many other labor guys are in the jail? He says, I found no other labor guys there. There's about 10 bankers, about 7 ex-FBI agents, and so on. But be that as it may, the point I'm only making is that the basic background of the labor movement is a force for good and a force for community well-being. And we should try to understand that as we look at what's happening in the labor movement and what's going to happen in the 70s, which we are now about to enter. And the labor movement, which is initially born out of the Industrial Revolution, today faces a kind of a technological revolution, which is its dimensions are such and its scope is such that it's very questionable whether or not the labor movement can, without some drastic changes and reorientations, be able to survive or be an effective instrument to cushion the impact of modern industrial society on the working people, or whether it can be an efficient instrument for continuing to be a bulwark of our free society, or whether it can play any significant role in the kind of an environment we should be building in this country. And that technology I talk about has to do with not only the sweep of automation, which is decimating the blue-collar jobs, where our greatest strength lies in terms of numbers, and which is bringing up problems now about how can you strike a plant that's 6 blocks square and has only less than 100 people employed in it. And the 100 people, with the exception of the janitorial force, they're all highly trained technicians walking around in white coats. Because that's what you see if you visit modern plants in America today. As far back as 1950, I visited a plant in France, the DuPont licensed Rayon Mill yarn plant. And there, as far as you could see, seemingly block after block of aisles, you'd see a technician there in a white coat twisting a dial here and there. Well, that automation has not only continued down to the present time, but in addition, an exception, it would have been a very significant factor today had it not been for the heating up of the Vietnam War and the phony kind of industrial activity that precipitated. It would have been a much more serious problem facing us in America in this instant. But that not only has continued to the present time, but it has intensified now through two other developments, one being the huge mergers that are taking place on an ever-increasing scale. If you read the New York Times today, because of the drop in prices, there's going to be more grabbing up a corporation after corporation expansion through the merger process. They get stock prices a little bit cheaper, and they buy those companies a little bit cheaper. But through the process of these mergers into big conglomerates, capital accumulation now is on a huge scale. And the expense of putting in automated machinery now becomes within the framework of any particular company that wants to do it, and especially the big important companies in this country. And the need for doing it, because of the need for increasing production, ever-increasing production, which is being accelerated now to a still further institution called the multinational corporation. Well, these are factors which are going to make difficult the future of the labor movement in this country. In the first place, they say, how can you strike a plant that's 10 blocks square and has 100 people in it? Your economic power to cripple that corporation and stop its production is diminished tremendously. Every time you get a new conglomerate, you take, we had one big corporation in St. Louis called the Abex Corporation. It was a foundry operation. It was about 3 years ago when we first organized 300 workers in that plant. It's now since been bought up by the Illinois IC Corporations, which is a conglomerate. But at the time I organized, it was a pretty big company, and we couldn't get a contract with them. We couldn't get any economic improvements for the workers after we had won the election. We had to go and put up picket lines around 20 other plants, I guess, throughout all over America, 20 other big foundries, in an effort to put enough pressure on them that they'd sit down in St. Louis and deal with this legitimately. Finally, we were not at all successful after putting up 20 picket lines, and I took a plane to London for the purpose of conferring with the officials of the English, the French, and I think the German labor movement. So this company had foreign plants and affiliates to put them down in those countries. It was at that point that I got a call from America saying, come on back, we can work this thing out, and I came back, and we got the kind of a contract which we could afford to recommend to our membership. But this is one union doing that particular thing, but no other locals that I know in America could afford to put up 20 picket lines in a big company, and no other local union in America could afford to go to Europe and shut down foreign plants of these big, huge American companies. So that the sheer economic power of these huge aggregations of capital almost make it impossible for American labor to handle the new conglomerate or the new multinational corporations. As an example, one of these huge corporations get in a fight with the textile workers because they own 6 textile plants. But they also own 12 plants manufacturing parts for automobiles. They own a small railroad or an airline. So the profits in these areas are all piling in while the textile workers are sitting off by itself trying to fight a corporation with this continuing source of income in that one area that the textile workers are involved in. Well, this kind of a labor movement cannot win with a conglomerate. In the ALA, we tried to meet some of that problem by doing... And the AFL, under the programs initiated by Walter Ruther in the Industrial Division, are trying to meet that problem. First, they're trying to meet it in the Industrial Division, by Industrial Department, by pulling in all the unions involved in a company into collective bargaining, trying to set uniform dates for contract expirations, and that way have enough of the people involved so that if a strike has to take place in order to get benefits, the total of the income of that particular conglomerator will be shut off, and pressure for them to deal equitably with the workers will be maybe available to us. The other thing we were trying to do in ILA, in the ALA, the ALA, Alliance for Labor Action, the other thing we were trying to do there was work up a, if we could have gotten all of the labor unions, America concerned with social problems, which they weren't at that time, We were hoping there, if we could get 10, 20 of them, we'd set up some kind of a common strike fund so that unions faced with absolute extinction, which is happening to them every day, local unions are being just simply destroyed because they cannot win against this kind of economic power. We wanted to put up some kind of a joint strike fund which would be sufficient to maintain the workers at some level of decency so they wouldn't be forced to go back through the picket lines in a strike situation, a struggle for improved conditions. Well, these are the kind of things which are happening to us. Now, not only is it difficult for an existing labor movement to fight and to win concession and to play its role as a buffer for the cushion for the worker, but the situation is not improving in that respect because with the sweep of automation, the area in which we have our greatest concentration of membership, the blue-collar jobs, is being cut down and cut down and cut down. I recall maybe 5 years ago, before Johnson stepped up the Vietnamese War, for the first time, I think, in our economic history, you got a picture of the blue-collar group coming, which is continuously rising, coming to a plateau and stopping rising. And then when they stepped up the war, the blue-collar jobs continued to increase. But for the first time in a stable economic situation where you didn't have the influence of an outside influence of something like the war, the blue-collar category had reached its limit, and had this war not begun, would have today shown a rather substantial decline. And now that the war is over, you're going to see a return to improved, increasing amount of new equipment in the plants in the interest of productivity, and you're going to find a further slashing of the blue-collar crowd. I think the figure is something like 50% of our membership is actually in that particular category of work. And 43% are in the blue-collar jobs, and only 10% is in the service industries. Service industries, incidentally, are the ones that are picking up some of the jobs that are being destroyed in the blue-collar field, because it's an expanding leisure kind of industry where hotels, resorts, airplanes travel, things of that sort is ever-expanding in a prosperous situation. But there we have our weakest strength. And so that the labor movement facing an ever-expanding workforce is actually standing still, and it's going backwards. Compared, for instance, to 1953, we had 17 million and or 27% of the civilian workforce. In 1973, we've got 18 million in the organized in the unions, but it only represents 23% of the workforce, an ever-decreasing amount of the percentage of the workforce, and thus, relatively speaking, a weakening of our authority or our strength in the on the industrial scene. But whatever the deal is, whatever the problem is facing the labor movement, it's going to have to meet it. It can't sit by with the challenge and not be in a position to effectively combat it. Take the ITT, which we're currently reading about, how it interferes with the internal government of Chile. Well, these same conglomerates, these same huge corporations, the multinational corporations, especially like General Motors, they are today, General Motors has a cash flow, I think, only exceeded by about four or five countries in the world today. And that's how huge it is. Now, it's almost independent of the nations, because where it has a problem with one country, it can always threaten to withdraw from that country. They can always affect that country's economic well-being, and it can wrest considerations from nations now that never before was available to them. And as a result, it is in a position, these huge corporations, as an example, the other one, which we've been reading so much about, having to do with antitrust cases, I guess the same one, ITT, it has such influence that it can literally destroy the kind of a democratic setting in which, only in which, a labor movement can flourish. And that it is in a position, a combination of these things, are today in a position, even in the United States, strong as our democratic traditions are, they are in a position to affect political decisions that should rightfully rest with the electorate and with the people of America. They are being there in a position to make those decisions. They're in a position to adversely affect the democratic rights of our citizens, and thus affect the very right of a union or ability of a union to live in the particular society. Because wherever a society breaks down and fails and loses its freedoms, that society has first had to destroy the labor movement. And the biggest examples, of course, have been in Italy and in Germany, where they destroyed the labor movements as a prerequisite to the establishment of a fascist setup. And this is going to be becoming more and more possible today under these kind of environments that labor is facing, and which labor must fashion some kind of a machine, some kind of a movement that can effectively fight on this particular industrial front and literally on the whole question of its continued existence. A second problem which I touched upon at the moment has been this business of the growth failure. At least there, if we could grow numerically, that alone gives us strength. Even if we are shrinking a certain area of the economy, if our numbers are growing, we can continue to be a significant force in the decision-making of our whole total society. The only places available, really, for picking up big numbers now, of course, are in the expanding white-collar group. That's government employees, it's the airlines, it's the resort industry, hotels, etc. And this is where we're going to have to apply ourselves. The second big area where there is growth is in the areas where most minority workers are to be found, which is the lowest paid, lowest scale jobs. Best example being, of course, the farm workers. And this is where the American labor movement has got to apply itself to serious efforts to organize and to build numbers in order to hope to be able to defeat some of the forces which are gathering strength in opposition to us in the 1970s. Hospitals is another area where you have large employment of minority groups at very, very low wages. But I'm saying to you, now, a final area that I want to touch on, at least in terms of the needs of the American labor movement, is the kids which are in great numbers coming into the workforce. And they're kids which are largely alienated, not from our society, number one. Seriously, at least in terms of serious numbers, have no faith in what they call the establishment, and I'm not going to argue about whether they have good or bad cause, that's right or wrong. I would tend to sympathize with them more than be critical of them in that respect. But in any event, the labor movement is viewed by the kids also as part of the establishment. We don't have the kind of communication with the kids. We don't have the involvement in the American labor movement which we should have with the younger workers. And it's our failure to identify with them, to identify with the problems, identify with their experiences. And we are sitting there with a tremendous potential assistance that we're ignoring and not channeling and not harnessing and not making part of our apparatus and part of our struggle in improving the world that we live in. And this, I'm hoping, will one day be a part of the program of the American labor movement, an increasing part. I happen to run a local, if you'll pardon personal references, down in St. Louis. We try to stay as close as we can to our rank and file. So we instituted last year, every year we have a big, 2 years we have a big conference in which all of the things we stand for, all of our authorities are put down in writing and reviewed by the convention and voted upon by the convention, reestablished or abolished. Any new programs are generally submitted there also for their approval before they're instituted. But this group is elected one for every 25 members in the union. There's no officers elected. Rank and file stewards can, but this is a rank and file conference. And in preparation for that, in order to get even closer to thinking about membership, we call three meetings. We call one meeting of all of our women members to find out from them whether the union was serving their needs, whether the union was alienating them and not involving them, giving the opportunity to participate. And we had a very good spirited meeting there, and it was reflected in the kind of resolutions which came out of the convention, resolutions which stood strong for rights of abortion rights and for the Equal Rights Amendment and other things which women are concerned about. A second meeting we had was of all of our black members to see whether or not the union was serving the needs of our black members to the extent that they had separate needs from the rest of our group. And that was a very good meeting also. The third meeting we held was a meeting of the kids. Anyone under 25, everyone who was under 25, white or black, female or male. But that was our most disappointing meeting, it turned out, because apparently some of that alienation must run deep, and even a union which, and I could say this, I think without too much fear of contradiction, a union which tries to work closely with its rank and file, even our union doesn't seem to be in touch with the young kids in our organization. And we've got thousands of them in our 15,000 membership. So it's my hope that the American labor movement will move closer to the young people and will try to move them into the structure of organized labor, give them a role to play and a part to play in it, and see if we can pick up at least the strength that goes with that kind of a situation. Now, I'm mentioning kind of problems which are facing the American labor movement. The question becomes, what, if anything, can be done about it, and what is going to be the future of the labor movement in this country? And it's a difficult question, and I certainly don't have the answers to how you solve some of these problems, but I can only give you some ideas that come to my mind as I prepared for this talk and some of the things I've learned as part of my experience in the American labor movement. There is, of course, the question of joint negotiations, which will add strength to the labor side of the table when it deals with a big corporation or multinational corporation especially. It is an asset to us if we can pull ourselves together to the point where we can establish joint strike funds. And, of course, it is to our benefit and would be a significant factor if all of the American labor movement participated in the international bodies which represent national unions and which brings closer together the auto workers of Germany and the auto workers of Japan and the auto workers of America and of France and of other countries. They're all in the Metal Crafts, Metal Trades Federation, International Confederation of Metal Workers. And this sort of thing can help us in this area. Whether or not labor moves fast enough to do that, I don't know. There is a something of a barrier in the sense that the European labor movement, politically speaking only, is a more advanced kind of a union movement than is the American labor movement. And the George Meanies of our movement are not too friendly toward the international labor movement. I don't think he understands it, and whatever he understands of it, he doesn't like. So that this is a serious problem facing the American labor movement. They're going to have to get over some of these things, and they're going to have to go down some of these roads if they're not going to be wiped out completely. And finally, a area that I think is important to the American labor movement if it's going to survive is the whole matter of widening its perspective, widening its views, and changing its attitudes toward the total community. All you have to do is look at the cities as an example where a lot of our members reside. The decay that's there, the kind of education that's available to our people, the crime that exists on the streets. And it's quick, you're quick to note, if you just did it on a very selfish basis, that it does little good to go and get a guy $5 or $6 an hour if his family can't even walk the streets. Or, for instance, in the present period of inflation, it does little good to get $5, $6 an hour rates if the people are going to lose those increases as soon as they get to the grocery store. Or if they have kids that they can't get a decent education, no matter if they're making $5 or $6 or $7 an hour. So that only from the pure selfish point of view, unions should be concerned about serving the needs of their union, of their members, by concerning themselves about the problems of their communities. In St. Louis, in a crisis situation there involving some 7,000 apartments, 9 low-cost housing projects, when the St. Louis Housing Authority was 45 days from total bankruptcy, at the request of the federal government, Local 688 took over the total of the 9 projects. As a condition of taking them over, we insisted that we had the right to appoint all 5 new commissioners on the housing board. As a further condition, we pulled in a big meeting, the religious community, the business community, the black community, the labor community, and we set up an overall apparatus. And we raised something like $400,000, maybe closer to $500,000 at the end of 3 years we had spent, plus about $20 or $30 million from the federal government, because the federal government says unless this was done in St. Louis, there would be no funds forthcoming of any kind for the housing crisis. But we did that, and we did it in the interest, it paid off two ways as far as I'm concerned, because a lot of our members were living in those housing projects, and it benefited them. Secondly, it was our contribution to a community, our contribution to avoiding a crisis which had it exploded into total bankruptcy, there would have been a social problem of such dimensions as we've never seen probably in the city of St. Louis. We got an awful lot of residual benefits from that in terms of public approval and public friends as a result of the job we did there. People who never knew of the Teamsters Union, or if they knew about it and knew anything bad things about it, suddenly find themselves sitting in rooms debating approaches to the solution of this problem. Business concerns, which we were pulling in to do the work that had to be done in the spending of $20 or $30 million. All of this seems to us to have benefited the labor movement, and the rest of the labor movement must take this kind of a concern, otherwise they're going to miss a lot of allies they could have, allies which they need if they're going to survive, allies which they need if they're going to be able to restructure the economic decision-making machinery of this country. In fact, allies they need if they want to preserve the political freedoms of this country. But whether it's that particular crisis, which I refer to as in the housing field, organized labor has got to, it will, I think, find, but it's, if they, it isn't there, they've got to bring a lot of those community problems to the bargaining table. If they're going to serve their membership, if they're going to serve the society we live in, if we're going to dig into the total of the community to a point where we're protected against our enemies and where we can influence larger masses of people in the directions which we are traveling or in the directions which are significant for America. For instance, in 688, we have a clause in our contract which provides for employer contributions to what we call America 2000, man and his cities. It's a foundation we set up. It's completely under control of private citizens or as in any of the Teamsters Union officials on the board of that foundation. Yet we pour thousands and thousands of dollars into that year through collective bargaining. And the result is that we're in a position, for instance, to establish a heavily subsidized child care center, which is only there to give us a little experience of operating it, to give us the basis and the core of a staff so we can go out and build more and more of those in the areas where they're needed. It's a foundation which finances a housing department where staff is there available for our membership, and they're going to buy a house to come in, have a real top expert, and take a look at that house, get it properly appraised for them, examine it as to the state of the plumbing and the masonry and the other parts, whether or not it's a decent buy. All of the government schemes that they are to help a worker finance that particular house is available through this housing counselor. And other ways of financing are made available to them. But it's an effort, and it's not just for 688. Any person in the city of St. Louis can avail himself of that housing authority, just as any person in the city of St. Louis can avail himself of the child care center, and they do. And finally, for instance, we've got two big high-rise buildings, 118 and 128, right at the union office, which contains about 650 apartments, about maybe 40% of them occupied by retired union people, the rest occupied by citizens in the community who never heard of the Teamsters Union, so they moved into Council House, and it's the most popular single place of residents of retired people anywhere in America that I know of, because it's from the day we opened, we've got 650 apartments. Believe me, we got 650 applications pending. And I'm talking about serious applications where the leases are signed, where the deposits of the first month rent is in our hands. But it's because it's a house of retirement with a concern for the people who are in there. There's regular programs of all kinds of activities. We have our own buses, for instance. If something is happening, a circus comes to town or a concert is going place, we buy our tickets, we transport our people out there. But whether it's that or whether putting on a little art exhibit or whether it's having a flower show, these members are constantly active in the affairs of leading a very busy life. They have committees on every aspect of the operations of the buildings themselves. Nobody is running those buildings except the tenants. They have a meaningful kind of existence into their old age. Now, we've not only got those two big buildings, we've just taken over three other big we built one for the University of St. Louis University, and we're just opening it now, and we're going to manage it. We're managing the latest big turnkey project, maybe 500 apartments on Forest Park Boulevard. We've taken one big operation over from a church which could not handle it, could not even fill the apartments, and did not have satisfied people. But what I'm saying is, here's a union that's moving into the needs of the community and building friends and making significant contributions at the same time to our own membership. And I think the American labor movement, part of the solution to facing the 70s with all of the new problems, lies in that kind of activity on the part of the American labor movement. More and more, we've got to involve ourselves at the bargaining table with the problems of the community. I think it's a shame that we sit in the richest country in the world, and we have a minimum. This statistic is outdated at the moment. Of a need for 140,000 new schoolrooms in this country. It's probably now closer to 200,000 or 250,000 schoolrooms because of physical conditions schoolroom. That's not going to add any schoolrooms necessarily. It's replacing schoolrooms which are unfit for kids to have to go to school in. They're portables or all kind of stuff. When you get into the South, they're much, much worse. But whether it's that or the need for another 1,000 universities, this is a study out of Congress indicating the need a couple of years ago again, of over 1,000 universities are needed in this country. Now, you say, well, we got enough universities. We haven't got enough universities. There's thousands and thousands of kids who are stuck in community college, and I'm not disparaging those, because we helped build them and we helped bring them into existence in St. Louis. And there are thousands and thousands of other kids who are automatically excluded from colleges because the colleges are jammed and they're just taking the cream. The kid who is a B average or less hasn't got a shot at going to school. Now, there's a lot of these kids who have a good shot at further development themselves, better training for themselves, but it's not available in the richest country in the world. Well, labor should get itself excited about those sort of things, should try to do something about those sort of things, and it can become, again, the kind of respected force in American society that it has occupied in the past, and I'm sure which it was going to have to occupy if it was going to survive the 70s. I was looking at a slogan the other day. Big thing, we can put a man on the moon, but can't put a kid in a daycare center. And that's exactly what's happening. We have the money for the war, we have the money for the moon, and he's cutting back right now on daycare centers. The one we have, for instance, is heavily subsidized by the union. I think we contribute about $30,000 a year to its existence. There's a state fund which we draw upon, and then the federal fund. But its very existence is threatened unless the union comes up with what the federal government is paying, because they're now throwing out all of that. And it's so stupid to argue about women who are on relief with five or six kids and say they should be out working. Well, how the hell are they going to work if they got five kids? They're going to let them run ragged through the streets and unsupervised only to get into trouble? We saw that at the Housing Authority in St. Louis for working mothers, thousands of kids in those apartments, just simply unsupervised, and we pay for it because they've wrecked that outfit, for instance, like Pruitt-Igoe. These kids get in all kind of trouble. I don't care whether they're black, white, green, or yellow. If they're a child, they've got the energy, and if they aren't disciplined or if they aren't supervised, they're going to get into difficulties, into trouble, and they're going to be destructive in many of their acts. Well, in any event, this is the sort of thing which we should concern ourselves about. We should do something about the need for recreational facilities. We should do something about the racist nature of our society. We don't live in a society anymore in America. We literally live in two societies, one black and Chicano and one white. And this is not a healthy situation for this country to live under. And how long it's going to be able to continue to exist in this kind of a situation, I don't know, and I have some serious doubts about it. And finally, there is an awakening on the part of the labor movement as a result of this stupid war we just concluded. I hope we have concluded it. And about labor has a right and should have a voice in foreign policy decisions which so vitally affect the welfare of our people and our nation. We did hold in Chicago a meeting of trade unions concerned about the war, and we established an organization to stop the war, end the war. And it was the first time in the history of American labor, to my knowledge, that any such conference took place. It took place without the approval of the top echelon of the American labor movement, but it did represent about fully by the internationals who were present and the membership they represent. It did represent about 35% to 40% of the organized labor movement in America. Now, this, I think, is a very, very significant development for the first time around. We've had a small meeting maybe 5 years ago on the war in the city of Chicago, but it was not a significant meeting, and this was by chosen, voted upon delegates. You couldn't walk in from the streets and sit in there. You were in the visitor section if you were, but they had delegates there, and we legislated upon the war and the end of the war and the calling for peace. Now, it's just overdue for the labor movement to stop going in the White House or whatever president happens to be there and say, everything is all right with the war, you're doing a good job, keep it up, and so on. We should be critical of the nature of the decisions that are being taken on the international front. We should be critical of the role and the function of outfits like CIA, which we have nothing to do with and we have nothing to say about, and I think they are significant factors in the welfare and the well-being of the American people, and we should be influencing these things. I think that if labor can move in some of these directions I've been talking about, I think we can win enough allies in the other segments of our population that together we can maintain a democratic society, together we can maintain a viable labor movement, and together we can build a kind of an environment that all of us would like. Well, so much for me.